like, this is really important. I've been loving the hell out of it from wherever
Experience
it is.
Experience the National Institute of Dramatic Art from home with their first ever virtual open day on Saturday, June 20th. Learn more about NIDA's 15 performing arts degrees with live talks from teachers. Hear from alumni, watch never-before-seen videos of student work, or try a NIDA online class. Whether you're interested in acting or a career behind the scenes, find out what makes NIDA one of the world's top performing art schools. Search for NIDA Virtual Open Day to register. NIDA sponsors 2SER 107.3.
And now it's time for Stages.
Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk
about all things
theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
You're listening to Stages, and I am Regina Botros, and this evening we are talking with Zara Newman. She has performed across many of the leading theatre companies across Sydney and Melbourne. Her credits include Miss Julie, The Effect, The Mountaintop, Cherry Orchard, Clybourne Park, The Drowsy Chaperone, Richard III, and Rockaby for Melbourne Theatre Company, Rosalind in As You Like It for Bell Shakespeare, The Blind Giant is Dancing, Ivanov, Private Lives for Belvoir, Love and Information for Malthouse, Sydney Theatre Companies. She was in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof last year. There's so many to mention. I'm not going to continue. She also was in the Australian version of The Book of Mormon. She's an award-winning performer, and I'm very much looking forward to talking with Zara Newman in a little while. And also later on in the show, Tricia Stars will be giving us a little bit of an insight into what the theatres are looking like at the moment and where you can catch the goings-on and how things are looking out there in the theatre world. And this is Zara singing from the show of the year 2014. You're listening to Stages, and I am talking with Zara Newman. She was in an adaptation of Wake and Fright earlier this year. She was on at the Sydney Theatre Company, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof last year. She's been across many stages, many TV series, and she's here to talk with me today. Welcome to Stages, Zara.
Hi, Regina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So, as far as your Wikipedia tells me, you're actually born in Jamaica and came to Australia as a 14-year-old. How was your, you know, younger life growing up?
I guess it was normal. It was, if you don't know any different, you know, that's what you think is normal. It was good. You know, I was in high school when I came here to Australia, and I came with my mum and my sister. My mother was doing some postgraduate study, so that's why we came. I think get an understanding of perspective when you have the opportunity to leave somewhere like Jamaica, you know, and see how life operates in other environments and other contexts. You know, sometimes I forget things like I did not have hot water out of the tap until I came to Australia.
So, Was it creative growing up? Were your was your mother creative or sister, or when were you introduced to the arts and theatre?
I was introduced pretty young. I mean, I would say that culturally, you know, the Caribbean and Jamaica we have really strong cultural connections and cultural ties. So things like music, performance, poetry, spoken word are intrinsically tied into who we are culturally. I mean, especially things like music and dancing and that sort of stuff is very connected to our story and our narrative as a people in terms of, you know, going historically, going back to things like slavery. We come from, you know, most of the people in Jamaica are descendants of slaves who came from West Africa and stuff like that. So the conversation and the narrative around who we are culturally is very informed by practices that are actually arts practice. So music, dancing, food, you know, all that sort of stuff. Mm. So, you know, you don't really necessarily think about it as art. You think about it as culture, as inherent to expressing who we are, understanding who we are and that sort of stuff. So I would say that I was exposed to it, you know, from a young age. But in terms of actually doing, you know, performance, it began in school with like speech and drama things. You know, we had to recite poetry and do competitions and stuff like that, and I really enjoyed it as a form of expression. And then when I was really young, I can't remember how old I was, I might have been 8 or 10 or something like that, I got involved with, I guess, what would be a version of a community theater group in Jamaica that is run through a missionary service who, you know, raise money for the poor and for people living in the ghettos in central Kingston. So we would do these big, like, arena spectacular kind of shows. There was, say, 1 or 2 shows a year. And, you know, it would raise all this money that, you know, would then go to sort of helping to feed and deal with health problems for the poor. So that was sort of my first introduction. It's definitely where I did, like, my first show or my first play production. Mm. Like that. And then when I moved to Australia, I really started to pursue it in a serious way. And I was in Queensland and I graduated high school quite early. It was never a prospect for me in Jamaica, thinking about my future. I never thought, oh, I would want to have a career as an actor, because that's not a viable career in the third world. you have to be way more, you know, what I call a slashy, like an actor slash teacher slash, you know. Mm. I mean, people have to do that anyway in environments like Australia, but especially in other places, you know, where there's not as much infrastructure or support, just wasn't viable. But when I came to Australia, I realized, oh, there's training and, you know, you can do it as a legitimized career here. And I was like, yeah, just go for it. I kind of felt like I've only got one life and I might as well spend it doing something that I like as opposed to something that I have to do. Yeah, that's kind of what gave me the opportunity, really, to pursue it in a serious way.
It's interesting that you talk about that early beginning and how, you know, music and theatre and performance and spoken word and all of those things, it's obvious, actually, because, you know, the theatre does represent culture, the beginning of storytelling, and now there seems to be this divide in a way, and or maybe even a return to it, maybe, possibly. You know, we want to tell Australian stories or we want to tell our own story. I'm getting a bit off track, but was there a point that was pivotal to you to move into professional, I suppose? Like, was there a turning point or a pivotal point?
Yeah, when I graduated. So, yeah, just I got to the end of high school and basically took a punt on getting into drama school. I mean, I was 16. I was very young.
Really?
And yeah. I took a stab at just going, I'm going to apply to go to drama school and, you know, see if this kind of works. And my mom was supportive to a point. You know, she kind of was like, look, if you do this and, you know, it's 5 years down the track and you're not working, like you graduate and then there's not, you know, you're not doing anything, you need to go back to university. You know, it was to a point. And that all comes from, you know, concern and care and all. Stuff. The reality is that, you know, in 5 years expecting to sort of be fully fledged and having a fully fledged career is kind of rare. You know, it doesn't sort of work like that. Anyone who's in the industry would know, you know. Trained for 2 years in Queensland at the University of Southern Queensland. And that was very, very formative. I mean, as I said before, I was very young.
Yeah.
And I actually got into my graduating year. I got into third year and realized that I was way too young to be, I did not feel ready or prepared to kind of be thrust into the professional industry. I didn't think that I'd be very successful just because I felt like I just wasn't old enough. I didn't have enough life experience, you know. So I transferred to Melbourne and I transferred to the VCA and basically went back to the beginning and started again. So I went back into first year. Mm. So all up, I did 5 years worth of training, but I wouldn't change that at all. I'm really grateful that I was able to do that. I think it really benefited me.
Tell me about what happened when you came out of VCA and when maybe a point was where you felt like you had, or something that was challenging, or some production that you were proud of. Because, you know, I'm not sure how long you've been performing and are you Melbourne based? Yeah, so a lot of your productions have been down there and we've seen you at Belvoir. I remember seeing you really early on in Belvoir productions and more recently. How was that, you know, is there a production that you're particularly proud of over the years?
Yeah, so coming out of VCA, I was really lucky. I managed to get a job at the Melbourne Theatre Company very soon after graduating. And that was just a really good thrust into what it's really like. You know, it's not a school. So that was a big learning curve. But pretty soon after graduating, I actually worked with Leticia Caceres, who's a director. That for me was an incredible learning experience across the kinds of voices that I want to engage with. Also massive learning just technically, I guess, as in terms of technique and what it means to be on stage and that sort of stuff, because really understood then the relationship between the audience, like what is that thing about theater and how the relationship, how that last element of the audience is so integral to what the show ends up being. They're your other actor. They're your, you know, they're the person that you're bouncing off, kind of, in a way.
At least. Yeah.
Also, yeah, just the, you know, that play, it was a play by a British playwright called Debbie Tucker Green. She's got Caribbean heritage. She writes about, you know, people who are Caribbean people. And it was just a very formative moment in going, oh, I, you know, don't get the opportunity to tell stories that reflect my heritage or in my voice, even, you know. That was a show that I got to speak in Creole, I got to speak in Patois in that show, which, you know, I mean, my friends in Australia don't even hear me talk that way, you know what I mean? So it was an opportunity for me to I guess engage with my work in a way that really related to who I was as a person, and that opportunity doesn't present itself very often.
Well, let's talk a little bit about race and race in theatre. Last year, the adaptation of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, you were Maggie. Has it been difficult? Do you think that there is a change in the theatre work that you are being given, the roles that you've been given, as an observation of a performer with your heritage, with your background?
There's so many questions in there, sorry.
Well, let's talk about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, like that experience for you, and what do you think that does to a player to take something like Tennessee Williams and those decisions, I suppose?
I don't know. I'm an actor. Well, I don't know. I do know.
You are.
I don't see why I shouldn't be able to play someone like Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I know that people disagree with that. People have many opinions about that. And that's fine. That's their problem. You know what I mean? Like there is a privilege that I think Caucasian actors or actors who pass or whatever terminology you want to use, there is a privilege that they have in that when they get up on stage, they are not politicized. I do not have a choice as a biracial person, as a Caribbean person who gets up on stage in Australia. I don't have a choice in the politicization of my body in that space. So people, when they see me in a play, are politicizing my body, regardless of, you know, what I'm doing, how I sound, who I'm talking to, whose mother I am. I can't control that. There are questions that are asked, there are assumptions that are made, and I don't have any control over that. And there was a point in my career that was very problematic for me and very frustrating. And because it didn't matter what I did, I couldn't stop the questions from happening, you know. And I've been in experiences on stage where I've been on stage talking, my acting, doing the scene, and I have heard commentary from the audience going, why does she sound like that? Why is she married to that person? I don't understand. She can't be in that play. She can't be, you know. So And wow. I can't do anything to change that. So I guess in response to your question about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Maggie is a gift of a role. It is a joy of a role. It's incredibly challenging. And I think anybody who gets the opportunity to do it, you know, will grab it with both hands and try to do whatever it is that they want to do with it. And I don't think that I should be denied that. I think questions around representation on stage, you know, people talk about, you know, why is it okay, say, for me to be able to play Maggie, but somebody else couldn't, say, play, I don't know, Michelle Obama or something. And it's like, well, there is not yet a level playing field when it comes to representation. And so until we're at that sort of stage, then I don't think it can necessarily flow both ways. And I was asked by people, you know, oh, so was she, you know, how did that work? Like, how does it work? And it's like, well, what do you mean? How does it work? Are you saying that I can't be married to somebody because they're white and I'm black? Like, what is your question here? You know, and people really grapple with stories, particularly stories that have really strong cultural memory. So things like Tennessee Williams, things like Noel Coward. I had a similar experience when I did a Noel Coward play. I did Private Lives and I played Amanda, and that was difficult for people to wrap their heads around sometimes as well. I think particularly shows or stories that have really strong cultural memory for people, there's a reason we return to classics. There's a reason we return to those stories, because they're really good stories and they're amazing to see, you know, come to life. But I don't necessarily think that that means that we have to do them in exactly the same way.
Do you think it's important to do that? To make us think differently about?
I think it's important that theatre in Australia reflects life in Australia. And when I walk down the street in Sydney or in Melbourne, I don't see a whole bunch of white people. I see people from Asia. I see brown people. I see people who are Arabic. I see people who I don't know what their background is like. And I think that if we are to hold a mirror up to life, we need to be truthful in that reflection. And so I think part of the reason that bodies become politicized in the space is because they are singular bodies. So it is one black person with a whole bunch of white people, or one Asian person with a whole bunch of white people. And that, while it is a step and is great, is, in my opinion, not enough until, you know, somebody can just be, hello, I am married to this person and we have a child, and that's the story that we're telling. You know, this attachment to, like, oh, it wasn't like that back then, and, you know, you wouldn't have been on a farm back then being the lady of the house or whatever. It's like, yeah, but we're not on a farm back then. It isn't 1890. It isn't, you know what I mean? This isn't a farm. This is a stage.
Well, that's a good point, because what you're talking about is theatre, is, even though you are looking at classics, you are looking at theatre now, is what you're saying. So, but that takes me to actually Wake in Fright. Now, I didn't actually get to see this. I did get to see you as Maggie, wonderfully. But I am interested in, this is another sort of, I mean, what I assume is, you know, a different way to look at the Australian male. So what happens when you take you and put you in the middle of Wake and Fright?
Well, we sort of broke it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I made that show with Declan Green, and Declan is like a very exciting maker and incredibly intelligent and exciting in the way that he kind of explodes narratives or explores narratives. And when Declan first came to me with the project, I was like, okay, all right, I don't really know. I didn't even know it was going to be a one-person show for ages. I thought there were other people in the show, you know, and then he's like, no, it's just you. And I was like, oh gosh, okay. What we really focused on was John Grant as the outsider, right? Because he's the narrator in the story, and he is
school teacher that turns up, yeah.
The school teacher, right. But he sits outside of the community, the Bunda Yabba, you know, the locals or the people, you know, he sort of sits outside of that. One, because he's deliberately placing himself as not one of those people, but also because he's recognized and treated as somebody who's not a local, who's not from here. So that was a really interesting parallel for us in terms of my experience as an immigrant. There's a question that gets repeated in the story about, like, where are you from, or you're not from here, and all that sort of stuff. So we kind of really latched onto that. And I would say that we more focused on that than, issues around, if I'm playing a man or if I'm a woman, and what does that mean, and how does that look? I mean, I was a woman telling this story about a person who is John, and I was John. So, if people need to make leaps and bounds in their head about that, well, then they can. And I think more what we looked at were narratives around Australianness and around Australian identity and what it means to be an Australian, and what are the stories and, narratives that get told or latched onto about being a real Australian or a true Aussie. How that stuff can actually be crippling, and how we in Australia hold paradoxes in our heads. We hold two opposing sort of things and we make them both true at the same time. For example, Australia as this very, very benevolent country and, very welcoming and all that sort of stuff. There are a lot of people who don't have that experience of Australia and being here, And so it's about the narrative and the reality and how those two things are sort of operating. I also had a very strong feeling that, again, this is a story that sits very clearly in Australian cultural memory. People have a really strong idea of what it is and what it should look like and how it should be and, all that stuff. And I can't compete with that. I'm never going to fulfill that for some people, a lot of people, right? And so how can we tell that story of a person who comes into a town and tries to navigate the sense of permission and welcome, this sort of false sense of welcoming and being taken care of that actually leads to his destruction. The more and more they say, come on, we're going to help you, the further and further it leads to his destruction. And what that sort of looks like now, and how that can be told in, I guess, an authentic way for me, as the performer doing that. So that's a kind of roundabout way, without telling you exactly what I did in the show.
Well, that brings us to, like, the importance of theatre now. And it's obviously, you started talking about how your first introduction was about culture and about storytelling, and all of this is about how, we are as a race or as a, a nation. What would you say, to government, or what, about the importance of what theatre does for us?
I think you only sort of have to look at how people have been craving spaces to congregate and be with other people to sort of, I think, people sort of questioning, how can we show that, the arts are beneficial? Look at how people have kept themselves sane during this lockdown time. They've turned to culture, they've turned to art, they've turned to content, that's what people need. They need to look, see stories and hear stories, and that's how people have kept themselves sane. If that isn't enough of a justification or example of the place that creative arts has and its benefit and necessity for us as people, as humans, then I don't really know how else to convince you. So, and that's definitely, I would say, what people are craving and why they're needing, why people wanting to gather,
Yeah. Well, one last question. What advice would you give to someone who is interested in being an actor or in the theatre industry, not necessarily at this time, but just in general?
Trial. It's all about trial and error. It's one of those art forms, I think, like many art forms, you learn by doing, you learn in the doing of it. And also continued training, I think, is really important.
But what are the tricks of learning by doing if you're not actually being, classes are hard unless you do improvisation, right?
Yeah, learning by doing, I would say, if you have an idea and you want to make a web series, then get your iPhone, get your friends, get your tripod, set it up and film it and do it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? If you have ideas, I completely acknowledge it's also the hardest step, right, to go from ideation to practical
performance.
Performance, or, yeah. And in a, I guess, a smaller version of what I'm trying to talk about is like, I hate seeing myself on film. I hate it. I don't like seeing my face. I don't like it. It's weird, right? It's like people hear your voice.
That's not what I look like, yes.
Right? It's like, oh, it's too close. But, you know, you're going to learn. What's really been really challenging for me, you know, because I'm trying to do more film and TV work, is that that's where you're going to learn what you're doing, right? Is by looking at what you're doing. So you have to engage with that step, like you have to do that, otherwise you're not going to really understand how it is that you're communicating. Because it's one thing in your head what you think you may be projecting, and people may be it may look a whole different way. People may receive something else. So I guess that's like a small version of what I'm sort of talking about. You know what I mean? Like, that's where you're gonna do most of the learning is in the practice part of it. But I also completely acknowledge that, and even at this time, particularly at this time, that it's sort of difficult to do. But you know, we're all in it together.
Oh, Zara Newman, thank you so, so much for joining me today and having a chat with me about your experience in the theatre.
No worries. Thank you, Regina.
Well, you've been listening to Stages, and that has been Zara Newman. I'll play a little bit of Book of Mormon, a musical that she was involved with. And coming up in a little while, Trisha Starrs will be giving a few what's ons that are on in the theatre, we hope. So stick around.
This book can change your life. Hello, my name is Elder Green. I would like to share with you this book of Jesus Christ.
We are asking here at 2SER for any kind of donation towards our much needed antenna that was struck with lightning. So dramatic. But if you're able to donate anything from $2 up, it's tax deductible. It will go towards helping us survive and helping us replace this essential item, an antenna. We are desperate for help. But yeah, no, if you are able to, then get online at 2SER.com and help us replace our antenna. So Trisha Starrs is back with Stages.
Hi, Regina. Trisha Starrs here with a What's On roundup for Sydney Theatre. And as you know, Regina, there's nothing much on because all the theatres are still closed. Now, there is actually something live at Darlinghurst Theatre. Now, as you know, Darlinghurst Theatre has a wonderful Two Trout restaurant. And what they have decided to do there is to run Red Carpet Cabaret, where they invite some of the best cabaret artists to sing while you have dinner. Now, this sounds fantastic. Tables are $500 each and they seat four people, which is quite good because you get a free champagne when you walk in and you get a three-course meal and you get some of the best cabaret performers in Australia singing throughout the duration of the meal. This is really selling out and there's only two more weekends left at Darlinghurst Theatre Company. So get ahead and book those tables. Due to social distancing, they are limited, but it just sounds like so much fun. And I really think it's the closest thing that we're going to get to live theatre at this moment. Now, there's another wonderful project. If This Be Nothing, it's a theatrical live stream jumping off from The Winter's Tale. Now, the way that you get on to see this is facebook.com/Montague Basement. Now, it has started running, but it's running until the 25th of June. So don't miss this. It's being created by Lucinda Howes and Saro Lusty Cavalieri. And it's based on The Winter's Tale, of course, by William Shakespeare. It sounds like a hoot, a lot of fun, and something to do on one of those nights where you feel like having a bit of live streamed theatre. Now, as well, I just have to mention STC Virtual. Sydney Theatre Company's virtual program is fantastic and it's all free. Some of Australia's top actors will be reading from plays, doing some poems, telling stories. and it's, you just go onto the SEC website and it just comes straight up. And they do live stream them, but they save them to the website so you can watch all of them or any of them at any time. So don't miss out on STC Virtual. It's a lot of fun. Well, that's all there is for me. I hope that gives people something interesting to do theatre-wise during this pandemic. Thanks, Regina. Bye.
Well, that's about it from me. You've been listening to Stages. This is Ursula Jovic. She is one of the performers of the cabaret goings-on at Darlinghurst Theatre. Get out if you can. Surely it will not be too much longer before the doors open widely for us to return. I've been Regina Botchus. This has been Stages. Thank you, Tricia. Thank you to Zara Newman for joining us. We'll see you next week with more theatre.